of W89.3 FM. That's the Labor Heritage Power Hour.
Thursdays from 1 to 2 p.m.
The heart and soul
of the American labor movement.
Welcome to On the Progress.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Randy Fertel. Randy Fertel holds a PhD in English and American Literature from Harvard University. He's the author of A Taste for Chaos, The Art of Literary Improvisation. His most recent book is Winging It, Improv's Power and Peril in the Time of Trump. How are you doing this morning, Randy?
I'm good.
Well, good to see you
this morning.
All right. I think we woke up together. But I enjoyed talking with you last night at Busboys. And today I wanted to ask you some follow-up questions, okay?
Love to.
Right. You've written that improvisation is a form artists employ in response to a new paradigm. During the era of Trump, has there been a paradigm shift?
Well, I think I would change that wording a little. It's a response to a new paradigm, but it also brings about, it's an agent of paradigm making. So when Galileo looks through his telescope and spontaneously sees that there are four moons and every night they're in a different configuration, he needs to develop a new hypothesis of you know, what is this thing we call the firmament? You know, above the moon, it's supposed to be all the same all the time. But no, it's not the same. And so that spontaneous moment leads to the shift from the terracentric, that the Earth is the center of the universe, to the heliocentric, that the sun is the center of the universe. So improvisation is often the agent of paradigm shifting. So, improvisers push back against the norms. It's not normal to see something new in the sky. And Trump pushes back against every norm that comes his way. And we've for 200, is it close to 250 years, we've had a democracy paradigm, and he now is instituting a demagogic paradigm, I'm going to call it a fascistic paradigm, a paradigm with the big man at the front, right. not the little man whose every voice counts. Now it's just his voice that counts. So that's a paradigm shift, and we really need to worry about it, because he has great his tropes of improvisation are very powerful.
Well, you know, some people might say that a paradigm shift was created by the pandemic. And I was wondering, was the improv coming out of the Trump White House responsible for many of the COVID deaths?
Oh, yeah. He caused a lot of, you know, I have the statistics in my book. Some World Health Organization attributed 40%, I think, of the COVID deaths in America to his sloppiness. He did move quickly on Carrico's vaccine. He does get credit for that, but the total lack of science, the standing in front of that camera for hours every afternoon saying ridiculous things that made Fauci and the woman with the scarf, I forget her name, made them wince every afternoon time and again. Improvisation has a role in the emergence of science, and I explore that in the book, but it is a paradigm that doesn't make evidence front and center. It makes things up. Improvisers are careful and clever liars. Hermes, the voice of improv, is the lord of liars in Greek mythology. And every time an improviser makes something up, it's a little lie. And, you know, art is made up of little lies, often to good effect and positive effect. But
let's look at something, because, you know, you talk about improv in terms of comedy, and I think of various venues. And I was wondering that, because we've had those regular press conferences at the White House, that the White mm-hmm. House got turned into like an improv club.
That's a horrible thought. Yeah. Not so funny.
Right. You know, like if they had moved it around, it was different settings. But it seems like every time you say, okay, I'm going to go here this like Thursday night or something like that.
Yeah. But, you know, his is more like a stand up routine. I make a distinction between stand up and improv comedy, because improv comedy is always a group affair. It's always a yes and proposition.
Well, I'm glad you said that. I'm glad you said that, because if you go back, Randy, then when you look at Vice President Pence just standing, he looks like the stand up guy.
Well, Trump, it was improv in the sense that it was call and response with the reporters in the room. But they weren't yes-anding. They were pushing back, and he was pushing back. There wasn't the rule of agreement at all. It was the rule of disagreement, because he's rather disagreeable. Mm-hmm. And he is the spirit of disagreement. Satan comes to mind, the spirit of disagreement. Mm-hmm. It was like Second City, maybe we'll call it Third City since it was D.C.
Right. Well, look, Randy Fertel, is there a relationship between spontaneity and speed? And one thing of the early days of the Trump administration, when he was using Twitter to communicate with the American public.
Improv, one definition of improv is that it's impromptu, it's in the moment. Mm-hmm. And the amazing thing about improvisers and hip-hop artists and rap artists is the speed with which they come up with that response to the call. It's just amazing. What enables it is that sense of presence and that sense of charisma, of bravado, that you are fully in your voice when you are improvising. And, you know, when you watch Hamilton, the speed with which those guys move, you know, it's scripted, but it has the impression of improv. And for the audience who doesn't know what that capping line is going to be, how the metaphor is going to be extended in the next line with a rhyme, it comes as a surprise every time. And so the one thing about the impromptu effort of improv is that it makes the audience improvisers. They're participating in this wonderful unfolding of the poetry.
You know, we have this documentary, like Black Twitter. I think that, you know, people look at Trump tweeting, but before Trump came on the scene, pretty much African Americans were like the major base in terms of use of Twitter.
So I'm not sure if you're being metaphoric or
well, I'm just
are you saying that the social media Twitter was
a lot of Black people were using Twitter. In fact, there's a documentary that just came out called Black Twitter, you know, where you see how it's being used. It gets back to the whole thing of speed and spontaneity. You know, I look at baseball and I felt that we talk about Jackie Robinson integrating, you know, the major leagues, but he's also bringing speed into the picture. So if you look at, you know, baseball being sped up by Jackie Robinson, if you look at Twitter in terms of communication, it speeds it up because, you know, it's almost like bebop. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, the black tradition of in the Renaissance, it was capping lines. You know, it was the sprezzatura of the courtiers was they would say one clever thing, and then the next courtier would pick it up and cap it with his cleverness. Mm-hmm. In the black tradition, I'm blank. The dozens is the form. You know, where you make fun of my mom and I make fun of yours, and it goes on. You call and response. I did a film. I executive produced a film in New Orleans about Mardi Gras Indians, and part of their tradition is capping lines. Mm-hmm. And we have a sequence where Tootie Montana, the chief of chiefs, I have to send you a copy of this. He's in a coming out of a parking lot, the Circle grocery store, famous in Treme, and he's capping lines with his spy boy. Hmm. It's really a lot of fun.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about what you're saying, and I remember a writer who I really liked, August Wilson, who did Fences and The Piano Lesson. He made a statement where he said, the core of black aesthetics is the ability to improvise. You know.
Well, that there's a yeah, absolutely, and I'm blanking on the which of the black women writers I quote who talks about the need to adorn. Well, that's Hurston, mm-hmm. The spontaneous adornment in African American aesthetic is crucial, and
And we would see
August Wilson is probably talking there about the way that it's in the nature of African-American aesthetic to find a way out of no way to create.
Based, his work is based in the blues. You know, he'll tell you that, you know, the key thing in terms of the blues. So we can see that manifest itself. And then when you make reference to Hurston, we see Hurston, you know, interest in terms of tapping into African-American folklore.
Yeah.
So
well, the blues form is you know, one line repeated once, mm-hmm. which gives you time to come up with the capping line.
Right.
And so you're building call and response. It's, you know, I'm astonished at the thread that weaves through all of this, that ties together all these kinds of improvisation.
Well, that's why your book is so interesting, Randy.
And that's what my book is really trying to do. That, you know, that as I was saying last night, that improv has become a thing. Mm-hmm. There are 60,000 books about it on Amazon, from boardrooms to your Presbyterian church. You know, how I'm going to make all your life better by teaching you how to do call and response. Well, that's fine and good, but in academia, finally, you know, I started this work in 75. Finally, it's become a thing, and the thing that's emerged is a phrase that I did not come up with myself, but they call it critical improvisation studies. But for me, the critical piece in the study of improv is figuring out how all these things that we call improvised or that suggest that they're improvised, how are they related? What ties them together? So that's what I'm trying to do. And for me, at the heart of it is disruption, is that paradigm shifting. It's the destruction of norms, which brings in a certain orange-tanned improviser who's really good at breaking norms. And it's not always a positive thing. It's a culture changer. It has brought about fabulous arts and fabulous cultural change, but sometimes it goes too far, and that's why we need to be aware of its peril.
All right. Well, you have used literary criticism to explain things taking place in the public sphere. Don't many of the Western texts that you refer to seem to be built on interpreting reality in a rational and logical way that might be in opposition to improv?
Well, that too is part of my sense of the critical enterprise that at the heart of improv is this opposition between rationality and non-rationality, that there's, we have these two minds within our brain. One is a cold cognition, the logical and rational, and the other is embodied emotion, hot cognition, the non-rational, the instinctual, the intuitive. And you know, when danger comes your way, you may be running before you even think the word danger. That's because our body is our supercomputer, and we can sense things before we are aware of it.
You know, one writer that I had the pleasure of meeting and talking with was Allen Ginsberg.
Wow.
And I think of him, you know, improvising and chanting.
Oh, yeah.
His first thought, best thought. You've written about his poem, Howl. Share your interpretation of that important poem that was written in 1955 and how it fits into your work. I think you once wrote that Ginsberg creates a new gospel.
Well, that is a wonderful poem, and it's not at my fingertips right now. But so that's, you know, about the best lives in our generation have been lost and to irrationality, but he's there to celebrate the non-rational, and I'm blanking on the person he's celebrating who's committed suicide, I think, but he is, you know, he makes him into this angelic force that despite his loss, he represented. And so, you know, we, you know, that book in which I explore how is called Taste for Chaos, because I argue that improvisers have a taste for chaos, but they don't swallow it whole. So in Howl, he's not urging us all to commit suicide, but he is urging us to, you know, recreate that Blakean vision that his friend probably went to his death embracing. Mm. So, you know, to see a eternity in a moment, in a infinity, yeah, in a right. grain of sand, that right. kind of thing.
You know, I remember reading Amir Baraka's autobiography, and he said that when he first heard Howl, it created like the new possibilities of what poetry could be. You know, so it was that impact. But I was also looking at the fact that if one looks at Ginsberg, and also the Beats, many of them are relying on Eastern texts. You know, and I was thinking about how the Eastern philosophy deals with, say, chaos.
Well, so, you know, one of the inspirations for this new book, this book that's meant for a general audience, Taste for Chaos, was rather academic, well-written, I hope, but it was about the Western canon, so, you know, not everybody's interested in John Milton and Tristram Shandy like I am. But so there's this terrific book by Ted Slingerland, who's not sure if he's at University of British Columbia or maybe at Stanford now, but he wrote a book on he's a historian of Chinese philosophy, and he wrote a book that had spontaneity in the title, so I had to buy it and looked at it, and it was, you know, it's full of all these Chinese characters which weren't always translated, and you know, I put that aside. But then years later, I caught a podcast he was on, and he was talking about this new book, which he called Trying Not to Try. And the idea was that in each of the generations of Chinese philosophy, from Confucius to Lao Tzu to Chuang Tzu, Mencius, all those guys, each one had a different way of a different method for being beyond method. Their effort, each generation, was to try not to try, to find a way to effortless action, what he calls wu wei. And that inspired me to have another swing at improv and to try to bring it home to a more general audience, because, you know, our former president says that his gut knows more than many brains. So he thinks he can get at truth by not making any effort, just as Confucius did, perhaps not with such distinction or intelligence, but with great power, because it appeals to the people who feel left behind in education and in their occupations, in their wealth. And so his tropes of spontaneity, which are perfectly in line with tropes of spontaneity that I find since antiquity, have great power. And they have great power because they have great power. They appeal to that hot cognition in us. We all are looking for authenticity and authority and agency. And the gesture of I can do this without trying is conveys those three A's: authority, authenticity, and agency. So, you know, we live in a world that's so regimented, so rule bound, and improvisers come along with three simple rules: say yes and a couple others, and they build a whole world out of it. And that's, you know, when you can do that in the moment with great speed, you're showing agency with great aplomb.
Well, let's look at, you know, we give Trump a lot of credit, but let's look at the other person that to me seems to sometimes be inside of, he was inside Trump's White House, but that's Steve Bannon. And Steve Bannon, you know, talks about chaos, and you talked about the positive and negative aspect of chaos. But to me, when I think of Steve of Bannon's chaos, it doesn't seem to be improv. It seems to be a really strategic strategy. It seems to be really thought out of what they're going to do.
I don't like to fall into the Goldilocks challenge where you wonder if it's improvised enough to be called an improvisation. For me, it's the impression of improv that carries that perilous message.
Well, see, that's trust what I look me. At. To me, I don't see, you know, when I look at Steve, I don't see improv. You know, I just don't see improv.
So, well, insofar as he's embracing chaos and mm-hmm. embracing breaking the norms, he's embracing improv. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the spirit of improv. You know, who is that Chicago economist who liked to say a disaster is a terrible thing to waste, and used it in Chile and everywhere else. You know, these are masters of disaster. Rebecca Solnit comes along and says, no, people don't need the rule of law to come down heavy after a disaster. She writes that book about the aftermath of disasters. And I think it's her last chapter, which is about Katrina. I'm from New Orleans. And she talks about the Cajun Navy, where the city was flooded, and the troopers or the National Guard were set up on the new shore, the new shoreline. And the good-spirited Cajuns showed up with their little navy, the little trailered boats, and said, we're going to go take people down off their roofs. And they said, oh, no, you can't do that. There's a rule against that. They, you know, this is martial law. And they said, no, we're going to do it. And so in the spirit of improvisation, they let them through. They broke the norms. Mm. And a lot of people's lives were saved. Mm. And that's the spirit of improv.
Let me bring another person in here to see how you relate to her work. And that's Naomi Klein, who talks about disaster capitalism. Is any way you see her work affected?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's what I've been talking about. I'm just terrible with names, and I can't think of that Chicago economist who his name starts with an M. And he is her main opponent, because he said disaster is a terrible thing to waste. You know, it's such an opportunity. You know, improvisers are masters of getting through locked doors. They find a way out of no way. And opportunism is rooted in that very image, because the opportunism is a gateway. And opportunists find a way where there's no way. It's been a while since I read her, but that book meant a lot to me. She makes connections that really astonish me.
Which is what you also do in your work. You make interesting
connections. Yeah, it's all about making connections.
Right.
Well, I think that book started to talk about social media in ways that surprised me. Maybe she didn't get that far, but my book does show that social media is a kind of improvisation that is very dangerous.
Right. Before we take a little break and we get into the second part of our discussion, Randy Fertel, I want to ask you a big question. You ready for a big question? Okay.
Yeah.
How do our democratic institutions survive improvisation? Because there's no mention of improvisation in the U.S. Constitution.
Well, of course, the U.S. Constitution was an improvisation. The democracy was an improvisation. It's shot through with improvisations. It's shot through with yes and. It's shot through with the vision that every voice counts, every vote counts. At the time, they weren't all counted,
the founding fathers of the improv group.
I think that Lin-Manuel Miranda had a real insight in turning not only the revolution, but the writing of the Constitution and the founding of the Republic, seeing that as a kind of rap group, an improv group. And I'm very proud of my chapter on Hamilton. I've tried to get it into his hands. That hasn't happened yet. He hasn't shown up to one of my book events yet.
He's probably listening to our show right now, Randy.
But what a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant play that is. And, you know, behind that, before he did Hamilton, he had this group called, he's one of the founding members of a group called Freestyle Love Supreme. He's a serious rapper. He's a serious freestyle rapper. And, you know, at the heart of that name, Freestyle Love Supreme, his director, in a great documentary about the group, points out that there's a reason that the word love is in the center of Freestyle Love Supreme. It's because there's really a band of brothers, to evoke a phrase that's big on this D-Day.
We're a band of brothers too, Randy Fertel. My guest today is Randy Fertel. We're talking about his new book, Winging It, Improv's Power and Pearl in the Time of Trump. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The show's On the Margin. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM. Okay, we're back on the margin with my guest, Randy Fertel, the author of Winging It, Improv's Power and Pearl in the Time of Trump. We were talking about the Constitution, and in your book, Randy, in your first book, you have a quote from Stanley Crouch, and Stanley Crouch wrote, "In essence, then, the Constitution is a document that functions like the blues-based music of jazz. It values improvisation, the freedom to constantly reinterpret the meaning of our documents." That's Stanley Crouch. I felt that he was.
Yeah, absolutely. That's very on point. And it's a process of call and response and of dialogue, of persuasiveness. And we've lost this because we're so tribalized that we don't hear one another. But we've got to find our way back to an embrace of persuasion and dialogue, and where every voice counts. That, you know, the process of debate, which, you know, it used, the Congress used to be a house of debate, and now it's just a house of invective. So we need to find our way back, and the beginning of that is by learning how to listen. One of the secret powers of improvisers is that they're great listeners. You'd think that the essence of debate is getting your voice heard, but it starts with hearing others' voices. So that's how improv works. First, you have to really listen to your fellow improviser in order to take his call and bring it somewhere fresh and new that helps build a narrative that brings us to a new, bigger culture.
Randy, hold on to that thought and extend what you just said into my next question. Uh-huh. My next question is, it seems that the period of Reconstruction should also be called the time of improv. And then I've also looked at after we deal with the Reconstruction, we see the whole rise of the minstrel tradition coming in and the use of comedy, some of which I felt was to restrain Black demands for equality. But just look at, you know, when you talk about which way this country is going to go, you know, how do we move the, you know, the newly emancipated slave into citizenship? You know, the country is how do you put the country back together? It seems that there's a lot of things happening during Reconstruction. You know, you mentioned about the founding fathers, but there's something very interesting going, experimentation with, say, public education. You know, this just seems that this is where there's almost a second constitution being written with all the amendments.
Well, so that's a very complicated question. And let me take a swing first at the minstrelsy part. Okay. So to bring up minstrelsy is to get thrown into PC jail, but actually minstrelsy didn't start as a race trope. It started as a labor trope. It started in the Northeast and in England, in Birmingham and Manchester, and in India where they had the cotton mills. So the jumping Jim Crow was a freedom that it was an appropriated gesture. This guy, Tom Rice or something, had seen a guy in the street dancing, and he turned it into a song and a dance. And so he turns about and jumps Jim Crow, because the mills of Satan, to use Blake's term, can't improvise. They always just go around in their circles. But Jim Crow can vary from the norm, and the race trope came in because it was taken down south, but the whole blacking up came because one of the things that these labor groups in England and in America did was that they wore black leggings, and that got extended. It became a metonymy for blackface. So that, I think, is the beginning of global popular culture. It's the first time that cultural events spread around the globe. From the Northeast to England to India. And I think that the advance of global popular culture has been driven by improv all along the way, and largely by either black voices or black appropriation. So you get minstrelsy, and then you get spiritualism, which is a kind of looking for agency in a non-rational way. It takes over 19th century culture. But let me get back to, and then jazz and so on, up through rock and roll and hip hop. But to get to Reconstruction, you know, I mean, it was such a mess, you know, with Lincoln's death. We got that racist Johnson in the White House, and he basically deconstructed Reconstruction before it got started. And then there was the compromise of 73 or 77, when there was this riot in New Orleans, where I'm from, and the racists who ran the Mardi Gras cruise took over the custom house at the foot of Canal Street. And to get them out of it, to get them out of the customs house, there was the compromise of 77, I think, that basically ended Reconstruction. So Reconstruction never had a chance. I mean, I'm not deeply read in Reconstruction, mm-hmm. but that's my sense of it, that we had a tiger by the tail, but, you know, like Lincoln said, I think it's Lincoln said that the problem with tigers is how to get off them. Once you got them, once you're on the tiger, how do you get off them? And we dismounted very badly.
Right. Well, let's talk
and
about
here. Here came right. Jim Crow and everything else that you know.
Let's talk about something that we didn't get a chance to talk about yesterday at Bus Boys when you had your book party and conversation. Talk about love. Isn't romance and dating often improv? And is the marriage that institution capable of surviving the changes in our society? I'm thinking about the influence of technology on our personal lives.
Well, that's a big one. So, yeah, love is a improv. But it's like Oscar Wilde says, master of paradox, that spontaneity is a meticulously prepared art. So, you know, in love is a negotiation, and you need to learn how to listen to one another and hear those voices, because every voice should be heard, and find a way to call and respond your way toward agreement. And
But you know, you could be out. You could be out in a restaurant. You could be out anywhere in the public, and it's two people, and it seems as if they're not talking to each other. They're on their own separate phones. They're in their own little silo.
Oh yeah, that's the saddest phenomenon these days. You know, everybody in their little phone, a cone of silence. Yeah, it's really sad to see that. And well, you know, there's statistical studies done with the kinds of effect even having a phone on the table will have on the conversation. And people like Sherry Turkle at MIT talk about that she studied the way teenagers these days have this way of, you know, being at a table, and they have this whole modality for their rules for who can be on the, you know, you have to have so many people not on the phone to keep the conversation going. And so you have to be attending to who's on the phone and who's not. And it's complicated, but it's, yeah, neuroscientists who study social media and iPhones and whatnot say that iPhone is a gambling machine in our pocket. We're always gambling for that next hit of dopamine, mm-hmm. and we're longing for it. It brings about a sense of feel good. It's the feel-good drug, right? It's feel-good hormone.
What about looking at this in the context of these improv groups, that just having the phone is just a prop? that I don't have to really use it. If I just hold it up, it makes a statement.
Yeah, and it makes it clear that I'm an agent. I don't need you. I can. I'm part of a larger world, and you know. So, community starts with a sense of togetherness, and you know, from the Arabella's great mission statement, John Winthrop. You know, we advance by charitableness. Mm-hmm. And charitableness means that sense of charisma, that this charismatic community is larger than it, the members of which it is a part, which are part, it is a part of. And so that iPhone breaks the sense of this is a community of saints. This is a completeness. The iPhone says, no, I've got connections elsewhere. I don't need this little community.
But look at how things, and just we can see this in terms of our politics today. It seems as if the whole sense of community, because of the technology, you just get into, like, as McLuhan about the global village. You know, what happens now is that if I'm in D.C., the community is Israel and Gaza, you know, because what happens there is, you know, I'm almost seeing it in real time. So I might as well be there. You know, we didn't have that before. I mean, you're looking at, you know, during the times of, say, after the Civil War, you know, we're dealing with like the Pony Express in terms of mail delivery, you know. So you're waiting for a letter to get from Boston to California. But today, yeah, it seems as if the community is completely redefined.
Yeah. And so, you know, the the interrelation psychologist, Esther Perel, terrific voice, she talks about the new AI is not artificial intelligence, it's artificial intimacy. So we have this intimate relationship with the world and all our friends on Facebook. But, you know, What is intimacy? Intimacy is vulnerability. It's communication. It's intercommunication. It's caring. And, you know, what she's saying is that this intimacy that is fostered by iPhones and internet connections is so thin. It has no depth. And I spoke last night about the historical irony that the sociometry, which is a study of the way people relate to one another, which is the foundation of Facebook and the likes and the friends, that community that we think we are part of, that so artificial, in Esther Perel's words, that science of sociometry, of studying, measuring one's social relations, was invented by a guy who was a student of Freud in Vienna and founded a theater of spontaneity in Vienna in the teens, the 19 teens. And Freud once asked him, so what are you doing these days, sir? And he said, well, you know, you're sitting in a room talking to people, and I'm in a room acting with people. We're building something. So his theater of spontaneity, he thought, could create a sociometry of people interacting and building, creating a narrative, a new narrative that pushed back against the loss of agency and community that industrialization was bringing about in Europe and then in America. And so he brought his theater of spontaneity to New York and was a psychiatrist there. And there he later founded this sociometry, which Zuckerberg took over and made the integument of the friends and likes which is you know, a casino in your pocket. You know, you're waiting for the algorithm, which connects you, that determines who you will be connected to when you post something. It determines who will see it, and it has studied, it's scraped, and it knows who has responded to that kind of post in the past. And so, you know, maybe it goes off to some politically right group because you're expressing lots of fear and anger.
Well, Randy, let's bring in a group that we discussed last night. And I asked you a question about the impact of the internet and access to the internet. And we're looking at the Amazon tribes in Brazil.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, some elders are concerned that the young kids are so concerned with, you know, the phones and stuff that they're not having time for their traditional, like, say, making baskets or something. You know, it's like they've gotten away from the things they were doing before they had access to these phones. So now, but at the same time, you can say, okay, is this a positive thing in terms of here are young people who were isolated in Brazil and in the Amazon now connected to outside forces?
Well, it's really, really frightening. I saw that piece in the Times too. And it's you know, the thought of those tribes people, many of whom have very little contact with the outside world, all of a sudden doom scrolling and seeing, you know, all these things that they don't have and won't have and can't possibly
you know what it reminded
obtain.
Me of, and I know you have an interest in film. It reminded me of the film The Gods Must Be Crazy Too, which a Coke bottle
comes in
and it changes a Coke bottle changes everything. So can you imagine what an iPhone does?
We need to revisit that. That's a really great point. Yeah, those two films were so great, so charming. There was this wonderful naivete to the tone of those films, which somehow partakes of the, you know.
Can you imagine an elder walking to the end of the world and throwing an iPhone off the
cliff? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, but you know, at least the iPhone needs a password to get in. The Coke bottle doesn't.
Well, as we come to the end of our show, Randy Fertel, I want to get back to what we see happening today, especially in terms of we were talking about Trump, but also the Republican Party. And my question is, what happens when a political party becomes only interested in comedy and improv more than passing legislation?
Well, so they're not really interested in comedy and improv. It's just a dodge. It's just a way of preventing dialogue, preventing persuasion. You know, they just flood the zone with nonsense. And improv builds through nonsense, through things that aren't exactly facts. They're subjective, you know, free association. It's in the nature of that free association you use to make the response to the call. That's utterly subjective. But out of that, you build toward, by intersubjectivity, by weaving your subjectivities together, you build toward a richer dialogue and narrative. And, we were listening to Amy Goodman before we got together, and she was talking about trauma. And one of the things about trauma, the way out of trauma, according to trauma psychologists, is that you need to build a new narrative. Mm-hmm. And I think that I argue in the book that trauma is one of the springboards of all this comic improv that we've had such a traumatic century.
Right. Well, one of the things I always emphasize is that if we talk about a new narrative, there's no new narrative unless we create a new vocabulary, you know, when you have new terms and stuff. But you know, we talk about the creators, and I want to end in terms of, okay, what about the audience. We're consuming.
You know, I heard recently at one of these talks, someone quoted Duke Ellington, who was asked, who's the most important member of your band? You know, and I'm sure the questioner was, you know, was it the drummer because he keeps the beat? Was it the soloist? And I found the Duke Ellington's response utterly floored me. He said, it's the dancers. It's the dancers, because I know if they're jumping, then we're doing something right. And so it's not... it's just in us, the call and response of the improvisers. It's really the audience. And as a reader response critic, we talked a little about that last night. I believe the meaning of the text happens not on the page, but between the page and me. So when I receive it, it becomes real, laced with subjectivity, which is in the nature of meaning. Science isn't interested in meaning.
Well, you know,
getting
back to Duke Ellington, I would have said to Duke Ellington, well, the dancers are nice, but what about Billy Strayhorn?
Well,
would we have some of these compositions if it wasn't for Billy Strayhorn?
Well, it's a meticulously prepared art.
Yeah, well, you know, well, we're having a little lush life right here, Randy. But I want to thank you for being my guest. I've enjoyed meeting you. I've said yesterday that I felt that your work is extremely stimulating. You know, it forces a person to look at the bibliographies and some of the books and the index, you know, in terms of who you're making reference to. And, in fact, I want to ask you this a bit quickly. Who are some of the writers, okay, could we talk about teaching, you know, improvisation study? Name like two writers that you would say, okay, these are people who produced a companion book. So you got my book, but here are other two books. Any names that we should be interested in?
Well, I mentioned Ted Slingerland, Trying Not to Try. Okay. And I'll add to that my friend Stephen Nachmanovich in Charlottesville. He's a violinist. He came to my improv conference in New Orleans, and he was the standout in a great panoply of wonderful speakers. But he holds his violin and starts playing, and then stops and starts talking about the nature of improv. Mm-hmm. And someone will cough and he'll say, you know, you hear that cough? Okay. That cough has never existed in the history of mankind in just that way. And that's what improv is. It's about presence. It's about being here now.
Okay.
Really? So his latest book is called The Art of Is.
Okay. And since you're from New Orleans, I'm going to say something that is closing. I thought I heard Buddy Bolden say. So I got to take
it
away.
Open the window and let that funky air out.
Right. Okay. My guest has been Randy Patel. We've been having a wonderful thing here. We've been talking about his book, Winging It, Improv, Power, and Pearl in Time of Trump. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The show's On the Margin. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
Thanks to all who contributed to or are thinking about contributing to WPFW's Relocation Fund, and to those who attended the reggae concert or open house. Your generous donations are what make all things WPFW possible. This is Miyuki. Special thanks to Joyce and James Kilgore, who made the commemorative Ellington 125 t-shirt and tote possible. They are still available as thank you gifts. Details at WPFWFM.org. Thanks to Mrs. Gloria Turner for everything you do. And thanks to you for partnering with WPFW to help build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
The Birchmere welcomes Ladysmith Black Mambazo, Tuesday, July 30th. Nelson Mandela titled them South Africa's cultural ambassadors to the world. Details at birchmere.com.
Albanidab returns to WPFW beginning Monday, July 29th, 2 a.m. till 5 a.m. with Music Memories, the best of old school from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Yes, the return of Albanidab on 89.3 WPFW FM, Monday, July 29th, 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Greetings. WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this year, you are automatically enrolled in this cherished group of listener members, and we thank you. Benefits of your membership are at wpfwfm.org under the Support Us tab at the top of the homepage is the Jazz and Justice Circle. Interested in joining this select group? Please consider a donation of $1,000 or more online at wpfwfm.org. Your donation helps WPFW build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Diego, this is John Kane, and I want to invite you to join me right here on WPFW on Fridays at 2 p.m. for Let's Talk Native. I will deliver guests and commentary each week on the real-life issues facing Native people. No romanticizing and no Hollywood stereotypes here. We'll talk real history and culture and life as it is and as it should be. Our shows are available as podcasts on your favorite podcast platforms and as videos on our Let's Talk Native TV YouTube channel. Find links and more at our website, www.letstalknative.com. And I'll see you here Fridays at 2 p.m. for Let's Talk Native with John Kane.
Brazilian music is back in its righteous place on WPFW. I'm your host, Roberto, and Berimbau airs on Sundays, 8 to 10 p.m. Are you ready to take a trip from Rio Grande do Sul to Amazon and back? That's Berimbau, Sundays, 8 to 10 p.m. on WPFW. Building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
African Diaspora International Film Festival and Africa World Now Project host the 17th Annual African Diaspora International Film Festival, D.C., August 2nd to the 4th. At the George Washington University Student Center, featuring fiction and documentary films, receptions, and Q&As. ADIFF DC from August 2nd to the 4th at the George Washington University Student Center. Tickets and schedule at nyadiff.org or 212-864-1760. ADIFF, where Black Life Matters. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hi, this is Tom Cole, host of G-Strings, here on WPFW every Sunday morning. I and the rest of the station's volunteers and staff would like to invite you to join the WPFW Legacy Listener Circle by making a contribution to the station's future through your estate plan. There are a lot of ways to do that, through your IRA or retirement plan, by gifting us life insurance, or through your donor-advised fund. We'd be happy to have a confidential discussion with you as you consider a planned gift to the station. Please reach out to us at plannedgiving@wpfw.org or call us at 202-588-0999. Thank you for considering becoming a part of WPFW's future.
Hello, WPFW. Summertime is here. Words, Beats, and Life and Arts for Everybody have the event for your family and friends this season. DMV Made Festival is happening Saturday, July 27th on the National Mall, a one-day celebration of the D.C., Maryland, Virginia region, promoting the intersections of arts and culture, plus health and wellness, featuring musical acts, Chuck Brown Band, Sweet Honey and the Rock, Substantial, Belladonna, DuPont Brass, and just added, the Blackbirds, celebrating 50 years of their classic, Rock Creek Park, plus four more music and dance stages, Family Fun Zone, Poetry and Storytelling Pavilion, live art installations, hands-on workshop tent, and health and wellness pavilion. Free to the entire community. July 27th on the National Mall. DMV Made Festival. Get more information and RSVP today. WBLINC.org.